The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please turn off your cell phones, please. I just had dinner with Fritz Stern. We're in for a great evening. He really is passionate about history. Well, as a young boy of 12, many of my neighbors went off to fight in the Second World War. As I grew older, I wondered why Germany had been such an aggressor that had stirred up two world wars, killing almost 100 million people. What made such an educated nation so brutal to some of its own citizens? Why had Germans nearly destroyed historic Europe and civilization itself? And why would this nation become so indispensable to the post-war recovery of Europe? Tonight, I am fortunate to introduce to you Fritz Stern. In his profound writings, he has tackled some of these burning questions of German history. Born in Germany in 1926, Fritz Stern knows his nation firsthand. He was the only son of a prominent Jewish family, and he narrowly escaped capture by leaving Germany in September of 1938, just 6 weeks before the notorious Kristallnacht pogroms. He then came to the United States, where he and his family assimilated quickly. He went on to attend Columbia University, where he later became provost. A student of history, he remained fascinated by his homeland, and has become the leading American scholar of 19th and 20th century German history. He has written numerous books on the subject, including the renowned Gold and Iron, about Bismarck's Jewish financial aid. In 2005, Fritz Stern received an award for his life's work on Germans, Jews, and the roots of national socialism from the German foreign minister. He is here tonight to talk with us about his new book, The Five Germanies I Have Known. His personal experiences bring this book to life, and his unique perspective as both a German and an American citizen make this book a powerful piece of history. He details how Germans have turned around from a belligerent people destroying over 6 million Jews to become a moralistic, peaceful country that is one of the biggest supporters of Israel and a force for stability in Europe and the world. Please join me in welcoming Fritz Stern.
Good evening, and thank you all, and thanks especially to Mr. Wax for the introduction which I was allowed to hear, and which in a certain sense actually said everything I wanted to say, and leaves me at some slight disadvantage. But it is a great honor to appear in this series that's named after Mr. Wax, and to appear at this great and important institution, which, if I may say parenthetically, opened, if I understand correctly, in 1894, the very year of my mother's birth, and in that subsequent 150 years as Mr. Wax has indicated, Germany has convulsed the world as it was convulsed itself. It is a special pleasure to be in Philadelphia, the seat of the Constitutional Convention. I say that not as a banal as it may sound. I say it for a specific purpose. It's the very thing that Germany did not have. Germany did not have a Constitutional Convention. It did not have what America was fortunate enough to have, the political embodiment of the Enlightenment, which is what was created both in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in this city. As I've often said to the Germans, the American institutions, and particularly the Constitution, is the political triumph of the Enlightenment. And I think it's our job to preserve not only the Constitution itself, but the spirit which had guided it, which is never completely secure. But that, as I say, was denied to the Germans, or the Germans didn't achieve it. And yet in that 150 years that I'm talking about, and that I try to talk about in my book, Germany was, as has been said, as you all know, convulsed by conflicts, by war, by utter degradation, and then by an extraordinary recovery over the last few decades. For all the triumphs and tragedies of that country, it still has to live with a past, with that past. And when you talk about the German past, we all know what we mean and what the Germans mean, which is the horror of the Third Reich. And Germany in that 150 years flourished in so many other respects. It had begun, as it were, it's a kind of, if you want, historical mission with the Reformation, but more than that, with the cultural awakening of the 18th and 19th century, with music, poetry, and the 19th century and early 20th century, with science. And it had achieved, even though it did not achieve a liberal order, it certainly achieved, to a large extent, the rule of law and a certain amount of rectitude. All the more appalling that that country, with so many achievements, was the country in which, as Mr. Wax called me, evil triumphed. The rise of National Socialism, its triumph at home, and here let me say parenthetically, its partial triumph abroad, which is often, we conveniently forget, that fascism in general and National Socialism in particular had its sympathizers, not only its adherents in Germany, but its sympathizers abroad. And all that, what it wrought, the harm that it, the infinite damage that it did to the world, to the Jews, and ultimately to itself, all of this in 12 relatively short years. I think it is still baffling to the mind that so much could have been done and such horror committed in so short a time. A world was transformed. A crime unique in the history of Europe was brought about with still, I would say, inestimable consequences to the mind and temper of our world, and particularly to the mind and temper of the West. In Germany's final lurch for greatness, it brought about not only its own downfall, but the end, as has already been mentioned, the end of historic Europe, and in a curious way, it ushered in the American century. There is a close relationship, obviously, between Germany's downfall and America's rise. There are many other reasons for this, but I just mention that as something that is often overlooked. I was born into history. I was born in 1926, and I happened to watch some of the horror that the world witnessed. I was personally remotely touched. I was, as a child, caught up in the drama from my fifth year on. Why I should have been so particularly affected by it is one of the many questions that I'm not sure that I know myself the answer. I have much to thank my parents for, I'm sure, who, particularly my father, who was himself politically very much alive. But when I say that from my fifth year on, I got a child's apprehension, at least, of the fact that we're all subject to outside forces. I was barely seven, just a few days before my seventh birthday, when I delivered the newspaper, the headline newspaper, to my father, which said that Hitler had been appointed chancellor. And I knew enough then to know what a terrible thing this was. Then he himself had already lived through some of the terrible storms of the 20th century, and as I'll point out later, by which I mean particularly the Great War. And I'd listened to his occasional stories, but I think at least as affected I was by the sight, which I can still conjure up in my mind, of the mutilated on the streets of the city in which I was born. The mutilated with their strange, in those days, odd and disfiguring prostheses, with their faces half cut off. And you'd see them very often, a reminder of what, by and large, though some people don't like the term, the British rightly call, and we call, the Great War. And yet, I do believe that, as I say, I was born to see this, to see the impact of history, outside forces, politics, upon an individual life. And yet I have to acknowledge my own view that my life is a series of accidents, some in retrospect predestined accidents, in the sense that an accident happened and perhaps I exploited it in one way or another or knew what to do. But nevertheless, I have every reason to be grateful to a number of accidents. And the book itself, which is the occasion for this friendly and kind invitation, was a predestined accident. That is to say, I was at a Dutch institute, and the head of it, who was a personal friend and colleague, fellow historian, said, "You have to give the farewell address at the end of the semester." And I said, "I can't. I have too many other things on my plate. I can't do that." He said, "Yes, you can. You have to. It's your third time here, and you have to do something, etc." And then he simply said, "Make it personal." And that was the beginning. That was when I gave a lecture called Five Germanies I've Known. It was printed by the Institute and gradually worked its way into a book. Let me simply say here that the book goes really against the grain of the historian. And I want to point out, even though the book makes clear that I was what I myself call an engaged historian, an engaged witness to our times, I was and am in awe of Clio's demands and achievement. I had abandoned the study, a pre-medical program at Columbia, to which, again, in some ways, I was predestined. My father, my two grandfathers, and my four great-grandfathers, all of them doctors, in a city in Germany called Breslau, which, after the Second World War, has become Polish and is called Wroclaw. And the expectation was that I started in the pre-med, and then, fortunately, changed my major and followed my interest to understand what I had myself witnessed, to understand the unfolding of what I think history is essentially, which is a great and terrifying, and many times terrifying, drama. When I turned to writing this book, I did discover that my parents had brought over a very large number of letters, some diaries, some of the letters going back to the mid-19th century, family documents mostly, but I'm talking, I think, about many hundreds or maybe thousands of letters, which I read for the purpose of this book, and the first chapter of which is called Ancestral Germany, the Germany up to and including the First World War. And I think I somehow thought Particularly when I found those letters, which I don't think my parents ever read again. They brought them over to this country, but didn't read them again. I opened them, untied the knots that had kept them together. And I thought that when I read them very, very carefully, that trove of letters demanded that life be restored to them, that somehow one should try to make that era come, if one possibly can, come alive, because the letters spoke of life and illuminated life. And so that I had the feeling I was in some ways, even in the very beginning, acting as an historian, I had source material. Quite aside from the fact that I brought, I hope, a certain amount of contextual knowledge about German history, having spent a good deal of time, spent all my time studying German and European history. And so the first chapter, Ancestral Germany, really deals with the life of my parents and grandparents before 1914. They were a family of assimilated Jews. By mid-century, mid-19th century, deeply involved in German life and culture, rather delighted, proud of the fact that they were living in a disciplined and dedicated society, aware of their Jewish origins, remote in many cases from Jewish practices, but also aware that there was residual, growing and declining, varying degrees of anti-Semitism. My paternal grandparents converted to Protestantism, which in the 1880s and 1890s in Germany was not altogether unusual, but it was still a small minority that did so in the process of general secularization, in the process of thinking that religion, that their allegiance to Judaism had weakened, just as Protestantism had become a far, if I may put it that way, softer, less demanding theology and ritual than it had ever been before. And so what one really converted to was a particular brand, in many cases, of Protestantism, but above all, one converted to that new and in some ways terrible religion of the 19th century, which we briefly call nationalism. That is to say, it was a way of fully identifying with the country. My paternal grandparents then converted, had their children, my father and his two sisters, baptized at birth. My maternal grandparents were unconverted, but had their children baptized at birth, as I was in 1926. Conversion, and we may want to go into that later, conversion certainly didn't protect one from anti-Semitism. It certainly did not protect one, as I'll point out later, from National Socialism. It brought about, in many ways, some amelioration of one's situation in, let's say, in academic careers and other careers and so on. And that is why many Jews who wanted to convert stepped back and said, no, if it brings material benefits, I'm not going to take a spiritual step that brings material benefits, be that as it may. Ancestral Germany was above all, in the case of, as I could make out of my forebears, a matter of work and family and what the Germans called Bildung, or self-cultivation. For my grandfather's father, indeed, for my great-grandfathers, I forgot whether I mentioned that they all four were doctors too, all in the same city. Medicine was a calling. Medicine was something that you really lived for, lived by, and gradually, which for me, I wish I'd had more time and knowledge to go into it, it was a period when medicine became a science. I do believe, and I know that as late as in my father's time, it remained a humanistic science. And a great deal of humanity and intuition went into the field as well. And the white coat in Germany was the one kind of uniform, if I may put it that way, before 1914, the Jews, converted or not, could wear and were admired by and large in it. It was, I'm certainly not trying to idealize that world of before 1914, but let me put it this way. It was a world that had a great deal that could have pointed in the right direction into a more peaceful development, a great deal of hope and promise, all of it, I think, or most of it, defeated by the First World War, the horror that began the horror of the entire century. It was George Kennan who called it the Ur-catastrophe, but by now I think it is general recognition that it was basically the beginning of the end of historic Europe. My father volunteered, as many Germans did, volunteered in August 1914 as a 19-year-old orphan, and I had discovered that I had correspondence both between my father and a chosen uncle, or paternal figure, who himself was a very interesting and knowledgeable lawyer. It corresponds between him and the person who became my mother. And one could see in those letters, the among many other things, the slow change that came over the spirit of people at the front, as it was called. I wish I could take time to talk more of what I just indicated, of what I call the promise of the pre-1914 period, of the presumption that there was quite strong in Europe as a whole, that maybe one was headed for a period of peace, that maybe, as William James made clear in a wonderful essay he wrote in 1911, The Moral Equivalent of War, modern wars are impossible, so that you had the presumption of peace, the presumption of social reform, the presumption of overcoming the class conflict. None of this was going to happen. The role of Germany in starting the First World War remains a deep controversy. I would simply say in front of some of my most esteemed colleagues who I know are in the audience, somewhat apprehensively, Germany did carry a particular responsibility for it. It was a combination of angst on the part of the leadership and aggression. And then once one was in the war, which after all started out as everybody expecting it to be a short war, one held out the insistence that one more push and one would win victory. And in the German case, it was also a matter of shoring up a pseudo-conservative reactionary regime. The head of, as it were, the titular head of Germany was the unfortunate Emperor William II, and I only mention him in passing to say that very recently there's been a new book out composed of the diaries of his military advisors closest to the emperor, who was the commander-in-chief of the German army. Who was, as I say, the supreme warlord, as he was called. And these two people who worked with him day by day as his chief lieutenants understood how out of it he was. And one chapter particularly intrigued me. It was called The Emperor Needs Sun. He has to be bathed in sunlight, and all dark thoughts have to be kept away from him. Well, you can imagine why that interested me particularly. My father contracted the influenza that was the next scourge of Europe in the fall of 1918 and came very close to dying and then had to organize his own retreat. And as I try to say in the book, his survival, which was by no means certain because the chief doctor had already given up on him, in the military hospital, made me, in some ways, a child, really, of the Great War. I'm not sure my parents would even have married without the experience of the war. Then came Weimar, which is the first Germany that I have some faint memory of. And you have to understand that it was an extraordinary attempt to establish a parliamentary democracy in a country that was not prepared, that had some of the prerequisites, but not many. And Weimar also, the attempt at a parliamentary democracy, was very much demanded, as it were, by Wilson, by American leadership, quite understandably, that they did not want to deal with a militaristic regime that had governed Germany before. I think Weimar is generally known to you as the great cultural renaissance, the great leap to modernity. Whether one talks about architecture in the Bauhaus, women's emancipation, children's education, or the purely transgressive violence of Weimar art in many ways. Unfortunately, also, there was tremendous political violence. The constitution that was drawn up for the Weimar Republic resembled to some extent the federal constitution, only vaguely, of the United States. It was meant to be a parliamentary democracy with proportional representation, hence a multiple-party system, and a strong, popularly elected president. This huge debate among historians, how flawed or not flawed the Constitution was, I confess to a simple view that it was perfectly, that it was a workable instrument for a democratic society. But Germany was not a democratic society. It was a deeply divided, radicalized society by the war, and that was obviously one of the great difficulties of Weimar. It is not for me at this time to talk about what Weimar was like, either the achievements, which were considerable, or the ultimate failure. I think basically, politically speaking, we remember it as the failure, and partly it was the power of the old order, the fact that the judiciary, the civil service, and certainly the army retained a large hold of German politics and German life, and they were unreconstructed enemies of democracy. At the beginning of Weimar and at the end, one had come close to having a kind of latent civil war, and extremists supported each other. The communists lived off the National Socialists, and the National Socialists obviously benefited from the communist danger. And that's something also to be remembered. Well, I remember my first Nazi, the first person in Nazi uniform that I shied away from in the summer of 1931 when I was 5 years old. More clearly, I remember the four elections of 1932, in which the Nazis made their huge gains, and so on. And I remember the street fighting in that year, 1932. Not for me to go into it now, just to say that it left a very distinct impression on a child, as did the fact that my father, both in his medical practice and among his friends, had some leading Democrats, social Democrats particularly, who were fighting as hard as they could against National Socialism in the years from 1930 to 1933. I remember as one of my first clear political memories, tinged with deep apprehension, that a particular patient and friend of the family, a patient of my father's and friend of the family, was the leader of a tiny splinter party in Germany of relatively little political importance, but locally important, which was tried to locate itself between communists rejecting Stalinism and at the same time locate itself as more radical than the existing Social Democratic Party. And this man, who was a Jewish lawyer, Eckstein by name, happened to be a kind of political tribune, or what we nowadays would call, had a charisma that extended particularly to the working class and had a great echo among the workers of the city where it came from, and therefore a particular target for the Nazis. Before they had seized power, they threw a bomb into his living room. And I simply remember as a child, the shock that came to me, and now that I retell the story, I also suddenly remember, of course, that too, the accident of his survival. I remember being told he didn't happen to be in the living room. He was in some room outside, beyond the living room. So I grew up, as I say, with death a growingly intrusive milieu. The end of Weimar, that is to say, it was a three-year agony or two-and-a-half-year agony, the end of Weimar has become, I think, a paradigm of democratic failure. And it used to be the case, maybe no longer as much, that German was the rhetoric of political debility. Of when you want to describe a bad, a politically dangerous situation, you refer to Weimar. I lived through the end of Weimar, and somehow the question of how Hitler was possible never left me or left my generation. The lessons, I think, not that I had them in mind then, obviously, but the lessons that dominated my life and that I think I mentioned that I spelled out in the book in some way, not spelled out, but alluded to, the fragility of decency, the slow subversion of constitutional life. It wasn't as if it happened from one day to the next. The death of Weimar took place over a period, as I say, of 2 years of subversion of a constitution under the legal sham as if the constitution still was in effect. And Hitler's appeal, again, a subject that many historians know better than I do, but Hitler's appeal, which had many, many roots, and again, can't possibly go into it, but that the pseudo-religious element in it, the claim that he was sent by Providence to save his country, to salvage the country, to free it from the fetters of the Treaty of Versailles, all that, I think, must not be underestimated. But in my life, in my writings as an historian, I would say, have said and say again in the book, National Socialism was neither accidental nor inevitable. And if that is true, then, in a way, lessons come very clear from that. If it was neither accidental, then, in other words, if it had roots in the society, then it was the task of the decent, engaged citizen to understand the depth of such a movement and also the demand upon the decent citizen to do his or her very best to defend existing institutions that in some ways at least guaranteed certain human rights and guaranteed a certain degree of decency. And that, as I say, the sense, the necessity of engagement, of civic commitment, was something that I felt, partly because I had seen as a child both the terror and the heroism of the few people that I happened to know personally who tried to stop what was going on. I then lived for 5 years from 1933 to 1938 under a National Socialist regime. And all that I describe in what I call my second Germany of the five Germanies. And I remember and describe, when I say I remember bits and pieces, and the rest, obviously, a lifetime of reading, studying, and trying to understand. But I do remember the instant intimidation and suppression. I still remember the day when the aforementioned Eckstein was murdered in prison. He was immediately imprisoned in 1933, in February 1933, as were, and this needs to be said, I think, the first targets of National Socialism upon coming to power were their political opponents, were communists, socialists, and Democrats. If they were Jews, they were particularly badly treated. But the point was, above all, to go after the political enemy. It was in the early days, in the very, very early days of National Socialism, that I, as a seven-year-old, learned for the first time of my Jewish origins and was defined as a non-Aryan, which suddenly became a new category according to racist thought. I might just parenthetically mention that a negative identity, what you are not, is not necessarily a fulfilling identity. But there it is. Again, I can't possibly sum up my experiences or the experiences that I try to depict historically of the first 5 years of National Socialism. The incredibly rapid consolidation of power in roughly 4 months. You're probably familiar with the fact that he came to power at the end of January 1933. In early April, a law was passed, the National Socialists always trying to have a pseudo-legal basis for what was called cynically the restoration of professional civil service, which meant that Jews and politically unreliable people could be sent into retirement at first from universities, hospitals, judiciary, from the entire civil service. And let me for a moment turn just to the universities, that bastion the Germans were so proud of, and rightly for so long, as a great German cultural achievement, and its autonomy that they had fought for, that they had tried to defend. Not that they were bastions of freedom, so to speak, in our sense, or liberality, but they had a degree of autonomy. And the fact that they allowed the Jewish, non-Aryan, and politically damaged colleagues to be retired from one day to the next, whether they were in the judiciary or in the university, so on, is something that, to some extent, still boggles the mind and needs to be remembered as a sign of the great horror which can befall a country. Because what I'm talking about is that the Nazis, who themselves, I think, were uncertain how fast to go, how far, were greeted, by and large, by the great silence, the silence of the majority of Germans, whether they might have been uneasy about the new regime, but at a time when certainly speaking out would not yet have meant martyrdom, might not even have meant imprisonment, people failed to speak out. And so what you had in Germany after the regime had established itself in 4 months and had established a totalitarian rule, you had, by and large, public order and hidden terror. And let me here say, by hidden terror, one should understand what that means. Prussia, for example, which has had a controversial historical account, Prussia had been one of the first European states to abolish torture in the 18th century. The Nazis, following the fascists in Italy, restored torture. First, in what were called the SA, the stormtrooper cellars, where people simply disappeared and were tortured. And then by March 1933, the establishment of concentration camps, publicly known as a measure of intimidation, and briefly mentioned in newspapers, briefly pictures shown of inmates. And again, I remember in the city in which we lived that some of the political leaders of the opposition, Social Democrats, were carried through the streets to the hissing and jeers of National Socialists on their way to concentration camps. The National Socialists managed a mass mobilization so that many, many Germans thought that somehow they were involved in the political drama of the time, at the time, obviously, of mass impotence. I've described all this many years ago in an essay called National Socialism as Temptation. And I mention that here only because the title itself was an affront, I think. Not that I was aware of it necessarily at the time fully, but it was an affront to those who thought that National Socialism was something that had been coerced, had been entirely demanded from the top down. No, it was for many people a temptation to believe in it. And that's another thing that it seems to me that we have to learn that these things can be a temptation. For my family and for many other Jews, non-Aryans, whatever you want to call people, there was the anguish of emigration, the incredibly hard decision to leave your country, your language, your background, your everything, and try to build up a different, a new world under difficult circumstances. Let me just say that I, as it were, deeply respect my parents who understood that they had to emigrate as early as the late spring of 1933, but then were tempted by various other possibilities of where to emigrate to, all this described in the book, so that we didn't make it till literally, as has been mentioned, till August 1938. And here, just to complicate the picture, I do believe that historians have the obligation, even in a short lecture, to complicate the situation, because that's what history is about. We finally had our American immigration visa. We finally had virtually all the papers. And in the middle of, and we had booked a passage from Rotterdam to New York, and we're in the process of packing up. When, in the middle of September, the doorbell rang late at night, late in the evening, and I opened the door, and it was the husband of an old patient of my father's, a major of the old German army, now in retirement, and whom I knew, but he'd never appeared in the evening, unannounced or whatever, and he said, "I want to talk to your father." I made sure that I stayed up to find out what it was all about. And he'd come to tell my father, "I've always told you not to leave. My wife needs you desperately. Hitler will go away, and you stay. But now that you tell me that you are going to go, I'm here tonight to tell you that Hitler is determined to go to war against Czechoslovakia, and I beg you to leave immediately, because if you stay, you'll be drafted as a doctor into the army." Now, I mentioned that as a complicating factor, that a major of the old army saying, because he'd been alerted by his friends in the Wehrmacht that war was imminent, that he should come and tell us to hurry up, get out, or my father would be drafted. And so there was a remotest likelihood that National Socialists would draft a non-Aryan or a Jew into the army. Be that as it may, it was decent of him to warn us. And I remember that the next night my father and I left, and I remember my father's tears as the train left and my unmitigated joy at being out. I have to tell you in passing that having done this book has certainly given me some satisfactions. It has also given me is giving me a certain amount of pain, because you hear now other people's stories, even of my own relatives, stories of what had happened to them, the tales that I didn't know before and that are heart-rending. Came to this country, and the last thing I thought, I was an enthusiastic immigrant, as you can imagine, just rejoicing in the freedom and the leadership of this country. Again, a subject that I go into and I try to make clear in the book. The last thing I thought that would ever happen to me would be that I would have a renewed relationship to the country that had sent me to exile, or would have sent me to death. But it happened, and it happened really by my interest, by professional interest, and to some extent the personal and the professional coincided, in the German past, in the long, long durée, the long term, 18th, 19th century, and so on. And I suddenly discovered that my colleagues of my own generation in Germany were struggling to some extent with the same subject, and that is what somehow brought me back. Let me just, in this unlikely trip back to Germany, there were several important moments. Again, accidents that I didn't expect that would be important. I was drawn into the controversy about the First World War in a huge German historical dispute. For the Germans, obviously, the past has been a continuing controversy, a radical controversy. I also, in 1954, happened to smuggle myself into a ceremony honoring the widows and children of the officers, and not a few who weren't officers, of the 20th of July putsch against Hitler. And that, and I can document that in letters I wrote at the time from Berlin, that occasion of seeing into the faces of widows and semi-orphans, whose fathers or uncles or whatever had taken their lives in their hand in order to get rid of the monster for whatever reasons of their own. I said at the time, I know their reasons may not have been ours, but the heroism of wanting to do this was important to me and shook up my blind feeling of hatred of Germans. I understood how complicated the picture was. I really shouldn't go on because I'm looking forward to your questions. As I say, I was drawn into back into German life through my own work, through helping or working with liberal historians in the Federal Republic, and more and more I visited it and lectured and so on. I visited what I call the fourth and forgotten Germany, German Democratic Republic, or East Germany as we called it, struck as I was at the time by the West German indifference to the East Germans, except for the occasional bemoaning of what happened to their long-lost brothers and sisters and so on. I also in my life, and I described that very briefly, had a chance to visit other countries outside of Europe and in Europe that were experiencing varying degrees of repression or recovering from political repression and finding among particularly Soviet and Polish dissidents in the late 1970s heroic examples of liberal courage, decency, and finally saw, of course, that triumph in 1989. And then the fifth Germany is the Germany that I called country that had a second chance, a partner in building Europe, a responsible power now in many parts of the world, including Afghanistan. It has a military draft. We don't. The country is still divided to some extent between East and West, between North and South. There is some distressing discontent with democracy, with unease about the working of the federal system. But basically, it is the best polity, I think, that Germany has had in the 150 years. It is an amazing story of the ascent to unparalleled barbarism and catastrophe, which wrecked Europe, and then this recovery of the last few decades, often under the protection of the United States. And the reconciliation with France and Poland was very, very important. I mentioned Poland particularly because, obviously, since my native city, which was German, is now Polish, I have happy ties to the Polish dissidents, let's say, who managed the revolution of 1989. Let me conclude simply by saying what is left to me is a sense that we are all endangered, that I remain a child of Europe's cruelest century, and that my fundamental, if perhaps obvious, concern is that the decent society, however imperfect, is so easily subverted. The siren song of nationalism, the promise of salvation, are so powerful, and therefore I think it's our civic responsibility to recognize immediately any latent danger. And therefore I want to end with the very first page of my of the book, which expresses basically my commitment and my sentiments better than anything that I could do myself and in the 500 pages of the book. It is, comes from the end of Albert Camus' The Plague, and if you allow me, I'll read it as the end. Dr. Rieu resolved, Camus wrote, to compile this chronicle so that he should not be one of those who hold their peace, but should bear witness in favor of those plague-stricken people, so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure, and state quite simply what we learn in time of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know, but could have learned from books, that the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good, that it can be dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chests, that it bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves, and that perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and the enlightenment of men, it would rouse up its rats again and send them forth to die in a happy city. Thank you.
Thank you to Fritz Sturm for that thoughtful talk. What we'll do now is we'll open the floor for questions. If you would put your hand up, we will get a mic to you. When I call on you, please keep your hand up so we can know who we're getting the mic to. Right here about six rows back. Gentleman in the blue.
Professor Sturm, perhaps this is not a fair question, and I apologize if it is not. You obviously have spent a tremendous lifetime studying Germany and giving us these categories, which are your book. But you've been in the United States for seven decades. Are you able, perhaps you've thought about it before, to tell us the Americas that you have known in seven decades and tell us what you see in them? Thank you.
It took me 6 years to write that book. I recognize the validity of the question. And let me confine myself simply to saying what I said at supper to my neighbor. It certainly is not quite the same country to which I came in 1938. It's a different country. And one, if you want me to go one step further, one that worries me in some ways. But I really can't do more than that.
Another question. All the way in back here in the blue. Sir, could you keep your hand up, please? No, sir. Sir, please wait for the mic.
In my studies of German history, starting with Brandenburg and Frederick and Frederick William, going on to Otto Bismarck and certain threads of German history, historians have seemed to feel that there has always been something in the German mind that accepts a strong leader. That's point number one. The second thing is the influence of Bismarck and the army and the philosophers of the time on Hitler and his philosophy. And the third thing is that during the Weimar Republic, that Stalin might have been able to take over Germany, the communists may have been able to take over Germany, but he underestimated Hitler, as many did. And I'd like to know your thoughts on those three things. Thank you.
But that's only the whole of German history. I am very uneasy with or critical of the notion that there's always been something in the German mind. That used to be very popular, and I can't tell you how many books there were, from Luther to Hitler, and so on, that there was, and I think I mentioned that at the very beginning in a throwaway line in comparing it to Philadelphia, the political breakthrough of the Enlightenment did not occur in Germany as it did in the West generally. And I can only tell you that this is a huge debate among historians worldwide of whether Germany had a special path to modernity or not. But it certainly did not have the political enlightenment that we see in that we have seen in other countries, ours included particularly. I really can't go into Bismarck. One of the most interesting, attractive, and abhorrent figures, all simultaneously. A young romantic, a young with immense courage in many ways, but ultimately a fatality for Germany because he did incorporate, he did embody the strong leader. And that is not what the country, as it were, needed for its political maturation. And he himself stoked civil discord by calling social democrats and Catholics, for example, enemies of the New Reich and so on. So that a very ambiguous legacy, deeply ambiguous legacy. And to go into the whole history of Weimar all over again, or what you call the philosophy of Hitler, which already gives him, I think, slightly more credit than I'd be willing to extend, is for another night.
Another question. A gentleman right here in the gray sweater. Sir, keep your hand up, please. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Stern, I have lived through four of your five Germanys, except for the Weimar Republic. And I would like to ask you whether you see, as I do, parallels between the Ermächtigungsgesetz and the Patriot Act. I would like to add to your voice.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Do you see any parallels between the Ermächtigungsgesetz and the Patriot Act? I would like to add to your voice.
I think it's imperative that one be very, very careful with facile analogies. It is the administration who, for example, who likes to make facile analogies between building democracy in the Middle East, as we had done in Germany, or if you're against certain things, you are a Munich person, you're a Pisa. Likewise, I think it's dangerous. Not that there aren't certain frightening, alarming similarities, but there are also so many profound differences between the two countries that I think to ask whether there are analogies between the Patriot Act and the enabling law, frankly, in a legal sense, hardly any. In a deeper sense, is it, under different circumstances, can it be interpreted as a step away from the spirit of a liberal constitution? One would have to, I would personally have to say yes, I think it is. But not to be likened in any way to what took place under National Socialism in March 1933.
Six rows back, right here.
Dr. Stern, it may be yet another facile analogy, but we remember that in Mein Kampf, Hitler made some dreadful forecasts, and he did his best to make them come to pass. We now have a ruler in Iran who is making dreadful forecasts. Is this perhaps a facile analogy, or is it a clear and present danger, in your opinion?
I honestly don't think that I can judge that I don't know enough, and I'm not begging off, but that I don't know enough about Iranian culture, political culture, to know what kind of reasoning, what kind of backing there is to the outrageous atrocity of his remarks, that they should be responded to with contempt and awareness and in some ways sanctions, as I think they are, that's clear. I would certainly hesitate to go beyond that.
Another couple of questions here. All the way in back, the gentleman in the white.
Professor, the question I have has to do with punishment, really. I was always dissatisfied by the level of punishment that Nazis received after the war, but just recently looking into it, there was almost no punishment of any kind for the communists for the mass crimes that they committed in the GDR. And I was just wondering what your perspective on that is.
It's a very good question. I think the what I call the de-Stasification of East Germany has, on some level, been more complete than the denazification in Germany in the 1950s, in the way of cleansing the teaching profession, for example, and so on and so forth. As for the punishment of the top criminals, your point is well taken, and I have no immediate answer to give. It is perfectly true that, as we all know, that some of the, well, that the head of the espionage unit, Wolf, died peacefully in bed. Should that have happened? And should he not have been tried? As some have been, incidentally. It has to be said that people who did the shooting at the wall and so on, they have been prosecuted. But I think you're referring to the leadership, which to a large extent disappeared. I'll have to think about it.
Right on the end here, gal in the green.
Dr. Stern, I was a journalist major when I was in college, and one of our studies was to look at how America is seen in the newspapers around the world. In your studies, have you ever examined how Germany was reported around the world during the time? I've done a lot of studies in where Hitler had a very liberal newspaper that he had to contend with in his rise to power. How does that make you feel to know, you know, how people viewed him around the world?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question.
Just how was he viewed around the world at the time? Because in Germany at the time, there was a very liberal media at the time.
Yes. Well, until his accession to the chancellorship, and even a little beyond that, there was opposition papers, and of every stripe, political and non-political. While at the same time, it has to be said that so-called conservative elements in German society, that is to say, people who thought themselves different from, superior to the Nazis, had a very, very large, well-financed presence in the German media. There's one name that immediately comes to mind, by Hugenberg and so on. And therefore Hitler not only had his own party press, but did have an easy access to German media. But the media also, as I said, had the other side until he came to power. Could it have been stronger? Yes, probably. Could the opposition have been stronger? Yes. But it was certainly, it was there. And there were enough. Don't forget that Hitler never won a popular majority in a free election. And there were enough Germans who sensed the evil and the violence and the threat of the possibility of war that hung over Germany in his campaign. But many, many, as I said in my, as I tried to explain in my essay on National Socialism as Temptation, many were tempted by the promise of renewed prestige, power, and this will-o'-the-wisp national community that triumphed over class differences and that that seemed to weld a people together under one leader. That was a very strong, in the beginning, a very strong temptation.
Thank you. I know this is not an historical question that I'm asking you, and you may not even want to answer it, but have you ever thought of what might have happened if the First World War did not bring about the Treaty of Versailles on Germany and put those harsh controls over the nation of Germany? Would there have been a Hitler, a Nazi Germany, if the Treaty of Versailles did not come out of the First World War, in your opinion?
Look, I made the random remark or the parenthetical remark about historians and complexity. And this seems to me a time where an appeal to complexity is necessary. The Treaty of Versailles, which incidentally I myself have always thought was psychologically more wounding than it was physically, in fact, or materially, though it was harsh, obviously. But it was a powerful rallying point against the young democracy, against the young Weimar Republic. And it is likely that it's conceivable that a softer peace might have made a significant difference. It would have made a significant difference to the English, incidentally, in maintaining the peace treaty, because they fell into this notion of let's not be beastly to the Germans after 1918-1919. But I would say far more, or more important yet, was the ability of the old order in Germany, the imperial order, with all that that implies, including economic forces and so on, to put the blame of Germany's defeat on socialists, on Democrats, on Jews. In other words, to disguise the actual military defeat of Germany. That was the great disaster and eased the path to Hitler.
Folks, I think that's where we'll end it. Please join me in thanking Fritz Stern.
Okay, I'll bring it up to you.
And please join us upstairs.